Jury versus Field. You may proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Kane. My name is Nicholas Granisar, and I represent the petitioner in this action, Brenda Sperry. This case presents, and not for the first time, I'm sure you know, the interpretation of CRS 1321-101, the personal injury interest statute. In my brief, I characterized 1321-101 as a mess. And after reading Justice Coates' dissent in USAA versus Parker, I think I was being too kind in characterizing it in that fashion. As far as I can determine, this is the first time that the issue of post-appeal interest pursuant to 1321-101-2B is presented for the court's review. I think it's important to point out from the beginning that this field does not dispute that Brenda Sperry is entitled to post-appeal interest. Post-appeal interest was requested by Brenda Sperry in her opening brief in the first appeal filed in the Court of Appeals. After that first appeal to the Court of Appeals, which resulted in a modified judgment in favor of Brenda Sperry, she requested post-appeal interest pursuant to 1321-101-2B. And the trial court denied the relief requested and awarded post-appeal interest from the date the judgment was entered, rather than from the date the cause of action accrued. In the second appeal, the Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court, and this court granted certiorari to consider whether the trial court and the Court of Appeals erred in construing 1321-101-2B by disregarding the plain, clear language of the statute and holding that a personal injury judgment creditor is entitled to interest following an appeal by the judgment debtor from the date of the judgment rather than from the date the cause of action accrued. The language we're talking about was adopted by the legislature in 1982. It was an act, quote, concerning interest payable on appealed money judgments in civil actions. In that act, post-appeal interest in the general interest statute was to be calculated from the date the judgment was entered, and post-appeal interest in personal injury actions was to run from the time the action accrued. This is post-appeal interest. Post-appeal interest is always going to be calculated from sometime earlier than the time the appeal is decided. Here, the trial court and Court of Appeals said that the calculation date is from the date of the judgment rather than from the time the action accrued, which is the language that the legislature used when they enacted the act. The question before the court today then is, how is that post-appeal interest going to be calculated? Which we believe is one of first impression since the decision of the Supreme Court in Rodriguez versus Schutt that was decided in 1996.
Counsel, at the risk of taking you out of your organization, can I just ask you a question?
Yes.
1321-101-B seems to have a contingency in it as well, that if a judgment for money is appealed, and that's what you all did, and then that judgment has to be modified or reversed, and I suppose that's what happened here with respect to the pre-judgment interest.
The judgment was modified, correct.
But only with respect to the pre-judgment, not with respect to the underlying substantive judgment, let's
correct.
Put it that way.
Correct.
Then the interest shall be payable from the date the action accrued. That's the language you're relying upon, right?
Yes.
So you say you met all three preconditions, if you will, or
yes.
Both preconditions?
Yes. The Court of Appeals focused on whether or not Ms. Sperry had requested interest in the original complaint, and she had. And she was not awarded pre-judgment interest. She wasn't awarded pre-judgment interest. The focus now needs to be not on whether she requested interest in the complaint, but whether or not there was an appeal.
What if she hadn't taken an appeal? Then the interest would have run from the date of the judgment? Post-judgment interest would have run from the date of the judgment?
That's what the judge indicated, yes.
And you,
she had not appealed.
But she did appeal?
She did appeal.
Okay.
Yes.
She did appeal. While we've got you interrupted, let me ask a question about Shutt. We took the sort of unusual step in Shutt of, after explaining our rationale, then pointing out exactly how the statute should be redacted or amended to comply with what we said. It seems that by leaving the definition of post-judgment interest that we did, that the statute, even as we amended it, did not comply at all with the rationale that we articulated in Shutt. If that's true, are you arguing that despite what we said in Shutt, recreating a distinction between pre-judgment and post-judgment interest, that nevertheless we're stuck with the amended language we said, and therefore we still have to, which I take it you're arguing, construe post-judgment interest to include both pre-judgment and post-judgment interest?
Post-appeal interest, yes, includes
post-appeal,
pre-judgment, and yes, and the damages. And I think the interpretation, and I think what the statute says at this point, is if you request pre-judgment interest in your complaint and you get a verdict, that pre-judgment interest is added to the verdict, and that becomes the judgment of the court. And if that's appealed by the judgment debtor, and that verdict is upheld on appeal, that you get post-appeal interest that comes back to the time the cause of action accrued. That's the way we believe the statute is at this point.
If you appeal and you get your post-judgment interest goes all the way back to the time of accrual, why isn't that, in essence, pre-judgment interest?
Well, it's not pre-judgment interest.
We're not calling it at that point pre-judgment interest, but just if you look at the timeline, here's the judgment, here's post. If by appealing, post goes all the way to pre, why isn't it effectively pre-judgment interest?
Well, it's because it's interest that it's not, number one, it's not interest that you're getting at 9%. Which is what pre-judgment interest is.
So you're getting it at post-judgment interest, but all the way back to a pre-judgment date.
Yes, because that's what the legislature...
So what's the difference in percentage between pre...
It varies from year to year.
So is that really what the case is? I mean, it seems so odd that if you appeal, you can go all the way back to the date of pre-judgment interest without requesting pre-judgment interest.
Well, it's in this case, and part of what the Court of Appeals was concerned about, there'd be a double recovery of interest. There would not be in this case.
But in some cases, there could be.
Some cases there could be, but that's what the statute says, as was interpreted by this court in Rodriguez versus Shutt. And the question I'm thinking going forward is, what are we going to do about that? If I think you have to enforce the statute as it's written, and if the legislature says, no, that's not what we intended at all, we didn't intend that this post-appeal interest would go back to the time the cause of action accrued, they can change it.
Well, the problem, it seems to me, is that you're not asking us to enforce it as it was written. You're asking us to enforce it as this court rewrote it. Correct?
Not really. I think if you take a look at 1321, 101.2b, that's pretty plain in terms of what it says. If a judgment for money in an action to recover damages for personal injuries is appealed by a judgment debtor, then the judgment's modified or reversed with a direction that the judgment for money be entered in the trial court. Interest is set out in sections 3 and 4, that's the market rate of interest, shall be payable from the date the action accrued until the judgment is satisfied.
Well, but that section doesn't apply to post-judgment interest exclusively. That's applying to the judgment in its entirety. Is that correct? In other words, so isn't it therefore consistent with 1A, with 1, as it was originally written, rather than as this court modified it?
You would incorporate prejudgment interest into the judgment.
If prejudgment interest is incorporated into the judgment, yes.
So then the judgment, if you got some kind of reversal, would go all the way back to prejudgment. So that would, in fact, be the double count.
Yes.
And that's the concern.
Well, that was a concern of the Court of Appeals. As I said, that's not a concern in this case because prejudgment interest was not added to the damage award. So this is a perfect case to say this is what the statute says, because you wouldn't have that concern about the double interest. But I think that's what it says now, and the question is, what are you going to do about it?
But sir, in most cases, there would be a request for prejudgment interest. Isn't that right?
Yes.
So this really is an exceptional case that maybe provides us with difficult facts to determine. Let me come at it a different way. Wouldn't you think that when the statute was written, there would be an assumption that there would be a request for prejudgment interest, as opposed to a need to kind of make up for the lack of one by looking at post-judgment interest?
Well, this is not making up for the prejudgment interest, this statute. You know, that's obviously the legislature intended to treat general creditors differently than personal injury creditors. When they said, in a general interest statute, you don't have to request it, but as interpreted by the courts, in a personal injury statute, you waive it. If you forget to put it in, then that's considered a waiver.
Right.
You waive your right to pretrial, to prejudgment interest. As I say, if you had requested it, it would have been added to the judgment, and then this post-appeal interest would be added on top of that. I think that's the way the statute reads at the present time. And the question is, are we going to leave it that way, or are we going to add something to it? I mean, you can take another shot at rewriting it, I guess, for the legislature, but I think that should be left to the legislature. And they obviously, since you decided Rodriguez versus Shutt, haven't done anything with this statute.
In order for you to prevail, do we have to change that case?
I don't think you have to change Rodriguez versus Shutt. I don't think you have to change it at all. I mean, as you modified it, it basically says post-judgment interest shall be awarded from the time the cause of action accrued. That's certainly consistent with what we're asking for here.
Scratcher, what's wrong with the Court of Appeals basis of their rationale of their opinion, which was that because interest is usually merged into the judgment, that 2B really assumes, that the date of accrual really assumes that prejudgment interest is included in the trial court award, and therefore judgment and post-judgment means just what it says, after judgment.
I'm not sure I understood that question.
Well, the post-judgment interest really means post-judgment interest, right?
Right.
And that's what 2B is really about.
Well, 2B, it's not. It's interest following an appeal. It's post-appeal interest. It's interest that a person is entitled to get following an unsuccessful appeal, which results in the judgment being upheld. Then you're entitled to get that interest on that judgment from the time the cause of action accrued under 2B. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Good morning. My name is Craig Kane with the law firm of Kane and Hayter, registration number 15930. Mr. Gradisar, justices. Certainly neither side requested oral argument today, so as far as Justice Rice's, I've really got no specific organization, so jump in at any time with questions. I assume that's why we're here, to answer some of the questions you may have with regard to this. In a nutshell, Plaintiff Sperry in this case acknowledges that paragraph 1 of CRS 1321101 allows or disallows prejudgment interest damages based on whether you request it in the complaint or you don't. Certainly, plaintiff acknowledges, Ms. Sperry acknowledges, that when such is not properly requested in the complaint, consistent with that statute, you do not get prejudgment interest. But plaintiff also argues that the statute says that paragraph 2 of that same statute subsequently automatically awards such prejudgment damages if the defendant appeals a judgment and is unsuccessful.
What's wrong with that? It's not unconstitutional or anything, is it?
You know, kind of thinking about that yesterday, if we were to reach the issue of constitutionality. We've got so many statutory interpretation aids we can use before we get to that. Certainly, it is a totally absurd result, basically for the statute in one part of the statute to say, okay, if you don't ask for it, you don't get it, and then subsequently, by simply appealing the damages, not simply just interest on the judgment, but a component of damages is applied to the substantive.
Well, I mean, it's saying you don't get it automatically on appeal either unless you, the plaintiff in this case, wins. So
exactly.
If the plaintiff had lost, that'd be the end of the interest issue on that part of it, the case, it's, right?
Well,
so
yes.
What's wrong with punishing the defendant for taking an unsuccessful appeal?
Well, again, as far as constitutional issues, one the problem is, as this court interpreted the meaning, the intent of this statute in the Rodriguez v. Shutt case, what we don't want to do is chill my rights and my client's rights to bring an appeal. Example, and follow up, I think this kind of touches on it. If I go to case trial tomorrow, or next week I get $1 million judgment, the case on a personal injury motor vehicle accident that took place 5 years ago. I think I have an issue that is probably a winner that could set aside half to the full $1 million. The problem is I've got $500,000 to reconsider as to whether I'm going to go forward on that appeal or not, because I'm essentially being penalized if I'm not successful by getting hit with 5 years worth of interest, prejudgment interest.
Well, you could pay the judgment, right, and take the appeal.
Pay the judgment beforehand?
Wouldn't that stop the interest run? Play it, pay it into the registry of the court? You can get it back if you win?
I guess that's a possibility. I never really thought about that. I'm not sure if that's a... I guess you could do that, Your Honor.
Let me just ask you to follow up on the Chief's question. What do you understand Rodriguez v. Shutt as doing?
Basically, I understand Rodriguez v. Shutt as addressing the issue of the constitutional issue of a difference in the interest rate between as to prejudgment interest or interest as to folks who appeal or do not appeal. And I do not believe it went past that.
And with regard to prejudgment interest then, not in terms of how anything is defined in the statute, because before we tinkered with it, it seemed to merge the two together, at least in part. But with regard to interest before a judgment, did we not seem to say in Shutt that it would be unconstitutional to distinguish interest payments prior to a judgment on the basis of whether the party appealed or not?
I believe, yes. In fact, that's right in the head notes. Essentially, there was. That's disparate treatment, and you cannot treat them differently. So you could certainly make the argument that by trying to hit a person just because they appealed with that interest would be similar to the Rodriguez v. Shutt decision.
Well, there's really no injustice here, because if she had put it in her complaint and gotten it, I mean, we don't have duplicate payments. We don't have this other problem that was mentioned earlier in the argument, right? There's sort of a revival going on here, right? Isn't there? She didn't claim the prejudgment interest, right? So
I wouldn't call it a revival, as the prejudgment interest as damages would be awarded for the very first time.
Yeah.
It was not a substantive part of the judgment. So it's not resurrecting the damages like she should have had them and didn't. She waived them. She didn't get them. So why is it automatically going into effect? Simply because I appealed.
Well, it isn't simply because you appealed. You appealed and you lost.
That's true. Simply because I appealed and lost. Then we get back to the situation where if I have other appellate issues, is this going to chill my potentially going forward on other issues if I know that this prejudgment damages to be potentially awarded,
but
slap
it,
me.
It seems to me somewhat analogous to the idea that in civil rights cases that the prevailing party is entitled to attorney's fees. They don't get attorney's fees if they don't prevail. And you often get into arguments about what does that mean to be a prevailing party. Isn't that all we would really be talking about here? What does it mean to really fall within the requirement for having an unsuccessful appeal?
Well, that's per statute, of course.
Right.
With regard to the civil rights, that is per statute.
Sure, you're saying, this would be too.
Can this statute essentially provide a prejudgment, prejudgment penalty, essentially, if you lose?
Right. So that's what I was suggesting. If the question is just how it would be difficult to apply, I was suggesting to you, well, courts do that all the time in the prevailing party issue.
Again, that would be going contrary to this court's interpretation of the intent in Rodriguez v. Shutt of what this statute is all about, though. With regard to that, again, this court said that as far as saying that the statements of the bill's sponsors, 1321-101, indicate an intent to neutralize the economic benefits and detriments of appeal under the statutorily set rate of interest. If they were discussing that and saying, okay, we're going to give someone a big disincentive to appeal because they're going to have to consider this award of prejudgment interest, everybody knows that up front. It's set forth clearly in the statute. This statute by no means says that. In fact, it would indicate the opposite, that it's not wanting to keep someone or, again, to neutralize the economic benefits and detriments. Look both ways. It's not really supposed to affect someone's decision to appeal, whereas I think that would, but I think it would need to be specifically set forth.
Well, but you're not making a constitutional issue. I mean, am I right? You're basically just saying, look, it's unfair. They didn't ask for prejudgment interest. They shouldn't get it now merely because there was an appeal we lost, and it goes all the way back to the date of the accrual, even though that's the clear language of the statute. Isn't that kind of your bottom line?
Well, basically, I think the Court of Appeals decision kind of touched upon that this might be unconstitutional. I think
But your bottom line, what is your position?
What I am doing, what I've been arguing first, is we don't even need to get there due to statutory interpretation, because the statute, the interpretation that plaintiff is setting forth is so absurd, looking at the statute as a whole within the statute.
But where can we find any other interpretation other than going all the way back to the date of the accrual just by reading the statute?
Well, I think you look at the intent of the statute. It is an interest statute. You take a look at the first paragraph, and it sets forth when such interest is so claimed and interest on such amount calculated. Basically, I believe the rest of the statute follows on that. There's a presumption, an assumption in there that, okay, you do have the right to prejudgment interest. That's what I think needs to be read into the statute, and it makes all the sense in the world.
Well, then the position you're taking is that if you ask for prejudgment interest, that then becomes the judgment. Post-judgment interest goes all the way back to the date of accrual, so we still have a double counting.
We could potentially...
And that's okay with you?
No. I think that is one argument that shows why the statute is ambiguous. Does that apply directly to the facts of my case? No.
Okay. I'm sorry to dominate your time, but
no,
let me ask
fine.
You one more question.
By all means.
You just said ambiguous, and about two questions ago you told me that you thought we should just look at the plain language of the statute. And I'm having trouble with that exact dilemma. It seems that your argument is that there's an ambiguity here.
I don't think I said, and if I said,
perhaps
look
I misunderstood.
The plain intent. I think
the plain intent
of the statute. Clearly there's an ambiguity because the statute does not specifically say what happens when in Kane's case, plaintiff didn't ask for prejudgment interest, he appeals and gets socked with it. That is not covered. I think that ambiguity can easily be explained by looking at the intent of the statute within the confines of the statute.
The intent being to prohibit prejudgment interest if it's not asked for?
Exactly.
So then a trial judge who's looking at this should say, okay, well, you didn't ask for prejudgment interest, but I would normally have to be awarding all of this post-judgment interest back to the date of accrual. But in your case, because you didn't ask for prejudgment interest, I'm only going to do it back to the date of the judgment, despite the language of the statute.
I guess that explanation of this statute kind of shows why the language of the statute is pretty confusing.
Mm-hmm.
In all honesty, I would agree 100% with Judge Coates' dissent in the USAA versus versus Parker case where he essentially says, that doesn't make any sense. What I'm trying to do today is just take care of my client. All we have to do is assume in this statute that all the following paragraphs assume that prejudgment interest was properly requested. That's a good point. Does this statute need a major overhaul? Personally, oh yeah.
I thought we took care of the overhaul.
With regard to the issues in Rodriguez, you overhauled pretty well, but it's about time.
Pretty surprising.
So essentially, if there are no more questions, that's about all I have, but I'm more than happy to answer anything you have. I appreciate your time. And what I would ask is certainly that this court affirm the court's appeals well-reasoned and well-written decision. Thank you.
I think it's helpful to go back and look at that original act that was passed in 1982, because when the legislature intended that post-appeal interest be calculated from the date the judgment was entered, they clearly said so in 512-106, which was passed at the same time as 1321-101 was amended to include the interest for on appealed money judgments in civil actions. We can speculate about why they treated post-appeal interest differently in the general interest statute versus the personal interest statute, but as a matter of fact, they did treat it differently. I'm not sure it's very helpful here to go back and try to see what the legislature intended, given Rodriguez versus Shutt, which held that what the legislature intended was unconstitutional. So I don't know where that leaves us there. And while we all might agree that the statute needs to be reworked, I don't believe it's the function of the court to rewrite it for the legislature. With respect to post-appeal interest, 1321-101-2B is clear and concise. And as this court stated in Stone versus Kerrigan in construing 1321-101, quote, to construe it to mean anything less or more than it plainly states would be to engage in judicial legislation to which we do not consciously subscribe. I think that the statute should be applied as it's written, and that this case should, the opinion of the Court of Appeals should be reversed, the case remanded to the trial court for the award of interest from the date the cause of action accrued following the unsuccessful appeal. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.